And welcome to the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler here talking about the world of money and investing and all of that good stuff from the perspective of... It was funny. I was actually... I can't even finish my sentences. That's just so normal for me. I was talking to a guy this week and he was having me write this thing and we're working on some just pieces for public consumption. And he said, you know, one of those things, Paul, you said you had 20 years, experience doing this way. And, yet you've been doing this for over 30 years. He says, I'm confused. I mean, was that just a typo? Did you do that wrong? And I laughed and I said, no, man, I did it the way most financial advisors do it for the first 10 years. You know, just misusing financial planning information, using it as a marketing tool, and selling, things that most financial advisors still sell. And that's typically how it works. They kind of get in the back door and do things, it was one of these things. I worked for an investment firm for years selling life insurance. That was the first year that was life insurance. Then I got my securities license pretty quickly after that. So we started talking about financial planning and went and got my got my first financial planning related degree. And then, a lot of the stuff that we were taught in the school, of course, you're working for an investment firm. And that's one of the things I have against a lot of the financial planning designations, the problem that you run into, and you got to be really, really careful. That's why I go outside of the industry for information, is typically they're teaching things that won't make the people paying for the financial planning classes mad. In other words, the investment advisor goes to work for the investment firm. The investment firm sends them off to get a financial planning degree. And then they've got to make sure that they don't teach them anything that would actually make them go against the firm who paid the bills. A lot of times the information isn't necessarily as straightforward as it should be, in my humble opinion. But, one of the things that we were big on at that point in time was life insurance annuities and those types of things. Mutual funds were improperly managed. A lot of buying and selling and trading and going on. And what happened was I went and studied under a guy who, I thought was... it made a whole lot of sense, where returns came from. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that just because it fits in with some of the political news going on right now. There's just so much going on in the political world that I have to talk about it. And it's because it's like the elephant in the room, really. But what happened was I said, that's it. I can't do this anymore. And I got out from working for the big financial planning firm and then went off and started a company on our own. And then shortly thereafter started this radio show. And the rest is history, as it were. But what I found that was really disconcerting is that you work for that investment firm and they are trying to get you to do things that are really, really good for them. And a lot of times investment advisors, they're just not as discerning as you think that they would be regarding this stuff. Matter of fact, I do a lot of speaking around the country to financial advisors. And I try, wake up, guys. You got to start looking more deeply at some of these things that you're out there peddling. Like annuities is a big one for me, just simply because the fact that you have so much money going into fixed income investments. And you have people doing this in their 50s and 60s and even early 70s that have many years in front of them. And then you have nothing to protect you against inflation risk. And people don't realize what a big deal inflation risk is, and I've talked about it many times that you look back in history in the 1930s, you look in the 1920s and you look at where countries you can just go into a more modern era now with countries that have devalued their currency and economic things have occurred in those countries to devalue the currency. And then all of a sudden people with all their money and fixed income investments are sitting there going, got nothing. As a matter of fact, I had this stark reminder the other day. I still have talk about laziness. I still have a life insurance policy. I don't know, there's not much in it. I bought it years and years and years ago. And it was a permanent policy because, that shows you what level of belief people, investment advisors, have in what they're doing. I bought one for myself. I had a permanent whole life insurance policy on myself, believe it or not. And I just kept it over the years. I don't know, it's just, like I said, laziness. I got a letter the other day. We've reduced your dividend. I'm like going, again? How many times? You know, I look at it and go, why do I just need to just get rid of the stupid thing? I just look at it and go, but it's such a minor part of what I've got that I don't even think twice about it, really. I kind of look at it as a savings account, really, quite frankly. Savings account aren't paying anything. It is my life insurance policy. But people sell these things as an investment vehicle. And they're horrible. I mean, they're just absolutely horrible. And you know, the thing that I find is that, you know, most people don't have a clue because people selling them don't have a clue because, you know, the managers are going, this is the greatest thing. Look at the tax advantages. Look at this. Look at the rate of return. You don't have to pay tax on the gains. You can use the dividends to buy more life insurance and increase it. You can do paid-up additions riders and blah, blah, blah. You know, there are a lot of, you know, bells and whistles, and most of them are like, okay, boss, you know, whatever. I'll do whatever you say I need to be selling. So back to, you know, looking at the political world right now, how does this all tie in with the political world? Things are getting mighty, mighty interesting. Now, I said that there was this guy that I studied under, and he came up with models to tell us what expected returns we might have out of our investment portfolio. And, you know, I talked about this a little while back, but it bears repeating simply just because there is so much of this out there. When I talk to people, typically when they have a 401k, they do the default investment option in their 401k, which often for you is a target date fund. And I'm going to get a couple specifics on something with you right here, just so you kind of know what you're up against with target date funds. And this also goes for when they allocate investment portfolios for you. They don't typically stray far from this type of a model. And I've done countless analysis of investment portfolios, and this is typically what I see. You know, people go, well, you know, they think about these target date funds and they think, well, they're less risky, aren't they? Isn't that a good reason to do these things? They're managing the portfolio for you, and as you get older, they change the asset mix. So maybe when you're 30, 40 years from retirement, it'll be all stocks. As you get older, they have what's called the glide path. And the idea being that as you get older, they'll start to add bonds to the portfolio until you get to your target age when you're going to retire. And then they'll have, you know, maybe 40, 50% bonds. Some of them are way too high in bonds when you get to retirement. And that's another thing. You look at it and they're different. You'll have different fund companies and they will have different glide paths. And you go, well, wait a minute. Why would they have such different glide paths? Isn't there just, you know, a handful of right ways to do this? If I'm retiring in 2050, why would, or 2040 or whatever year, wouldn't it make sense that all the fund companies are about the same asset mix? Now, you got to understand why that question is actually a valid question. 91 to 94% of your investment returns and the change in your investment returns and how your portfolio operates is based on what your asset mix is. How much do I have in stocks versus how much I have in bonds is one of the primary things. I mean, I always tell people that's the first thing we look at. How much do you have in stocks? How much do you have in bonds? If I have a long time to retirement, I want to hold more in stocks. And this is, you see this a lot of times with younger people, is that they actually are very scared of stocks and they don't have much in there. And that's when they should be most invested in stocks, typically, simply because they got such a long time. And when you look at what the most precarious thing that they've got going on in the financial world is that the dollar will continue to drop in value. The currency will continue to lose value. And when that currency loses value, they're losing money without even seeing it. It's a hidden tax. So what you want to do is you want to start off typically with more. And I say typically just simply because there are some people that might be, I don't ever want to go, it's always this way. That leaves a little room for when you're doing some planning for people. Sometimes you'll have people that are in industries that are highly sensitive to stock markets, for example, and you may not have as much in stocks in that particular case. So there's just a lot of different things. So if you hear me kind of hedging, that's why. So if we look at these target date funds, typically people say, well, aren't they less risky because they're managing portfolio for you? They're doing it and everybody's doing the same thing. And I always say, well, yeah, the thing is there's not safety in numbers when it comes to the stock market. You know, if you looked at the late 90s and the 2000s, you looked at 73, 74, you looked at, you know, 2000 and you know, you look at, you know, 1998, excuse me, and you look at various market downturns in history, And you'll realize that, you know, just because a lot of other people were doing what you're doing didn't make it safe. Y'all lost money. You know, so there's no such thing as safety in numbers, you know, when it comes to the stock market. Don't, you know, it's just because everybody's doing, don't, you know, then people do that. They have this, it's herding. It's called a herding bias that we have, and it can be really, really bad. So we look at, aren't they less risky? Are these things? Well, you know, if you look at some of the headlines, and, you know, some of the headlines that don't go back really all that far. You know, there were feds that were actually taking aim at target date funds at one point in time, was one headline. Target date funds failed investors, actually. There was another study that was done back, you know, remember when the 08 downturn happened? You know, there was no safety in numbers. 401ks, they took a beating. And, you know, there was concern that it could happen again. There was another headline. And there was another headline that was, you know, more recent. It actually said that investors should reconsider target date funds. You know, why? Well, because in investing, you have different things that drive returns. And the biggest ones, number one is stocks versus bonds. The other one is how much exposure to small companies versus large companies. Then another one is value versus growth. And there's a profitability is another one, which is related to value. And then there's investment, and then there's, you know, momentum. There are all kinds of little things that can drive returns. But I'm just going to focus on a couple of big ones right here. You know, if we look at, you know, where do I expect more return? Well, it would be with smaller companies and more value-oriented companies. Now, that doesn't mean it always happens. You may have a period of time, you know, a few years where growth companies do better or large companies do better. And then all of a sudden, then all the value will do better for a while. And then maybe small growth will do better for a while and small value. And what this does is it screams for diversification between all of them. And again, I got some really good stuff for today's show regarding the politics of right now and things that just going on. And I'm just watching and going, you know, I'm not going to make market predictions, but I am going to make a really good, I'm going to make a really good argument for why you want to diversify, especially with what's going on. Now, if we go back to, you know, 1970s and we look at areas of the market and we see, well, what area would have had the lowest return between large international, large US, large value stocks and small companies and small value? Well, the two that are really close to each other are large US and large international. You know, they would be close to tied for the lowest returns over that period of time. So big US growth companies and big international growth companies would be tied. If you looked at other areas of the market, value did way, way better. And we're talking, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of about fourfold difference in accumulation, four times as much money. You're looking at about fivefold for value companies, small value companies versus large US. So it's a huge, huge difference. And actually more, it's more, well, wait a minute. I'm actually just looking at it going, whoa, wait a minute. It's even more than that, Paul. It's about 10 times as much. So it's a big, big deal, big difference in accumulation between those two. Okay. Now, if we look at, let's say just a few fund companies and these numbers that I'm pulling for you go back to, I think they were earlier this year that I pulled these numbers. If you look at it, the John Hancock, the multi-manager 2035 fund, according to Morningstar, they had about 50% of their portfolio in U.S. stocks, about 31% in non-U.S. stock. Now, if you look at the percentages, about 40% was in giant companies, another 30 in large companies, another 20 in medium-sized companies. So literally over 90% of the portfolio in really, really big companies. And the leaning, according to Morningstar, was large blend to large growth. So where's most of the money? The vast majority of the money is in very big, big companies, and that money is in large and growth companies. Now, where did I say was the lowest performing going all the way back? You know, where it's literally just, like I just said, one-tenth of the money versus small value in terms of growth. Well, it's that, you know, that area of the market. And then if you look at, T. Rowe Price, 2035 fund, 50%. Very close numbers, 50%. You remember I said it was about 47%, 51%. Very, very close numbers right there. And it is the amount that's in large U.S. stocks. Where's the money? 41% giant companies, 34% in large companies, 19% medium. The amount of money that's in small companies and microcap companies, about 5%, a little bit over 5%. So again, well over 90% of the money in very, very big companies. Again. And then if you look at it, it's mostly large and growth. And then Voya Solution, 2035 fund, 47% large U.S. Just right in that 50% range, right? And this is something you see with fund companies. They have a tendency to do this where they all look alike. And it very well may be. I've had friends and people in the know, would their conjecture is that the reason that they do this is because there's safety in numbers in this area. You're less likely to be sued if you all look alike, if everybody looks alike. Now, what's the leaning again? Large blend, large growth again. Same area of the market, that upper growth area of the market where, of course, as we look at history, had the lower returns. Now, how much is in small companies there? It's actually a little bit less than the previous ones, just about 4%. But it's, again, it's 90, high 90% range is in large, giant, medium companies. And then you look at J.P. Morgan. There's their 2035 fund. Now, they have a little bit less in U.S. stock. It's 43%. They had a lot more bonds. So, you know, look at that and go, well, wait a minute. Why they have a lot more in bonds than their predecessors? And the reason being is, you know, well, they just, maybe they're betting. I don't know. You know, I don't want to make any kind of a guess as to why that they would have so much more in bonds, but you know, that you ought to find interesting in and of itself. Two different fund companies with the same target date, 2035, with very different amounts in bonds. One's 23%, and the other one, it's not as different as I thought it would be. I'm going to take that back. It was about 21%, so they're fairly close to each other. 18% for one of them. And then Putnam 2035 fund, again, very high, but they have a ton of cash, 26% in cash in their portfolio. Now, that, I would say, that is really weird right there. And, so you're looking at a lot of, and you say, well, why would a fund hold that much cash? Well, typically there are two reasons. One is to deal with fund redemptions, people pulling money out, and another one is to market time. So that's normally what I'll see is their market timing. Maybe they think the stock market's going to go down, so they'll hold more cash. Now, if they really knew the market was going to go down, why not hold all cash? Would be a question you ought to ask. Guidestone Funds, their 2035 fund, 47% U.S. stock. How much in giant? 48%, 34, 20, 12. How much in large companies versus small? Again, about 95% of the money in that particular fund. So you look at these funds, and then you can do what's called an overlap analysis on them. Like if you do a Voya's 2035 fund, if you look at an overlap analysis where you have, for example, companies that are in the portfolio like Microsoft and Amazon and Apple, what you find is that the holdings of the fund, large cap growth fund, high dividend, low volatility fund, index plus fund, T. Rowe Price capital appreciation. These are all funds inside the Voya portfolio, Voya large cap value fund. All five of those funds, and another one, actually number six, the Invesco Comstock fund, six of those funds own that one stock, Microsoft. Four of the same funds own Amazon, four of them own Apple, and four of them own J.P. Morgan. So you have overlap in the portfolio, and you go, well, what on earth is going on there? You'd have to ask them. That's all I'm going to say. And then you got, Fidelity 2040 Freedom Fund, giant companies, 45%, 27% for large and medium, 18%. You got 8% of the portfolio in small. That's where we expect higher returns, right? And you go, well, what on earth is happening here? Well, fund companies find that there is safety in numbers, number one. But number two, they find that you as the investor just simply like bigger companies. You like looking like the market. And you don't typically know a whole lot. Like when I gave you those numbers about small value stocks going back to the 1970s, I'm just guessing you probably didn't know those numbers were that stark. You probably had no idea there was that big of a difference between them. And reality is most investors don't pay attention to this stuff. So because they don't pay attention to it, they don't realize what they're missing over the long run. And because everybody's doing the same thing, you're all going through misery and happiness at the same time. Like when large U.S. stocks are doing well, you're all happy. When they're not doing well, you're going, oh, well, everybody's going through this. And you're saying, oh, it's just woe always me. The rich are getting richer and poor are getting poorer. And they don't realize that sometimes the rich got richer because they didn't do that. They didn't act like a bunch of lemmings running over the cliff at the same time. And, you know, they're aware of these types of things. And, you know, this is academic research. I'm not talking about brand new stuff. This is going back to the 1980s. And unfortunately, well, fortunately for me, I'm not going to say unfortunately, because I figured out, you know, it was something that I got, you know, introduced to 20 years ago. Thankfully, I couldn't have been introduced to it at a better time, because it was just before the tech bubble burst. And it was a great time to be introduced to how things really work. Well, you know, what happens is this, and I'm going to go through and I'm going to talk about total stock market index funds for just a second, because this is something that I see quite frequently that investors are holding on to thinking that they're really diversified. And I'm going to run through that just a quick second and just walk through this, because this is a part that I'm going to tell you, I can't think of a portfolio that I've looked at in recent weeks that they didn't have something like that in the portfolio. So I'm going to walk through why these things aren't quite as diversified as you think they are and what's really going on. Spend a little second on that right after this. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. All right. So let's... Hopefully I have convinced you that maybe the target date funds aren't necessarily the greatest thing to be in. So what do you do? Well, you'll typically have other funds to choose from in your 401ks. Not that you don't do your 401k. I love 401ks. It's just you take a little bit more control. And I got to be careful in saying this, because sometimes people will take control and then they'll sabotage it because, you know, like, for example, they'll go through a period of time where small companies are doing way better than large. And then they go and change and they get out of their large companies. And they put all their money in small. And then, you know, it's like last decade, you had large U.S. stocks had a dead decade. They did nothing. No return, actually a negative return for an entire decade. And then people started shifting over to, you know, international, because international had done so well. And then all of a sudden international, you know, doesn't do as well as large. And now people are wanting to ditch international and put in all their money in large U.S. stocks. And yeah, hang on, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. I got some really interesting numbers regarding that. Super, super interesting numbers regarding that. But let's take a look at the total stock market index funds. This is something that's really popular with investors right now. I was sitting next to a person the other day who's been fighting the battle that I've been fighting for, well, way longer than I have. And he leans over to me and we're in the workshop. We're winning. We're winning. And I looked at him and go, we are not. And what he was talking about is he just is. And I said, you're just referring to the fact that more money went into index funds. Which, you know, when I talk about index funds, you have a fund that invests in the market and just buys and hangs on to the stocks. Now, I'm not a great index fund fan because of the issues with them, with the way they're managed, and they're so lazy that returns in many asset categories like value and small value and so on and so forth are lower than portfolios that aren't as lazily managed. Now, I don't like stock picking. I don't mean, you know, get active and not be lazy in terms of buying stocks and picking which company is going to do better than others. No, that defeats the purpose. I'm just talking about lazily managed. They just buy everything in proportion to the size of the company, and boom, that's it. Now, I'm talking about lazily managed in the fact, in the issue being that, you know, for example, when the index changes, they have to sell all the companies at the same time that are being removed from the index. And they have to buy all the same companies that are being added to the index. It's a problematic issue. But he was just talking about the fact that indexing was starting to win was a victory in that people are basically walking away from active stock picking and market timing. And I looked at him and was like, no, you're misreading this. I love you dearly, but I think you're misreading this. And the reason I say that is because people are doing it because the area of the market that happens to be happens to have outperformed. Well, I happen to have, because if you look at the past few weeks, that has not been the case. But the area of the market that had been outperforming was large U.S. growth stocks in recent years, and that is what you'll find with index funds, what they focus on. That's the area that they're most focused on. And because of that, and because the management fees on those portfolios are so low to non-existent, now there's a race to zero, where they're managing the portfolios for zero. And you know, those of you that believe that actually anybody's doing something for nothing, you might want to think again. But in effect, that is what these portfolios do. And like, if you look at Vanguard's Total Stock Market Index Fund, there are about 3,500 companies in that portfolio. Now, remember what we said about large companies. And if you're just tuning in, I went back through the numbers, and I get a chance to check out the podcast. Go check it out, where I go through the numbers on large companies versus small companies versus value companies going back a few decades. It's stark. Big, big difference. Yeah, short version, large company growth stocks have the lowest, along with international large, which is another area that is indexed a lot, lowest returns by far. It's not even close. Now, people say, well, there's more risk in adding those others. Actually, what happens, and this is this concept won the Nobel Prize for Economics, is that when you add these other areas, this small and value and large value, you actually end up reducing historically the risk of the portfolio because they don't move together. And, you know, that's it. And I always have to say historically, because you never know. It might be the whole world's going to change going forward. And smaller companies are all of a sudden going to be able to use your money for way less. They're just not going to have to pay as much to use your money going forward anymore. Can you pick up the sarcasm? I said that to a friend of mine the other day. I said, you know, it's an interesting, people thinking that international small companies, well, from now on, they're just not going to have to pay anything to use your money. And he goes, oh, that's brilliant. And I said, no, it's just logic. You know, when you invest, you're letting companies use your money, and they got to pay you to use your money. If there's more risk historically, there's more what? Return. You know, but here's the beauty of it. If you look at when you add some of these other areas, you'll have those years where large growth companies are dropping, and in other areas, small companies are going up, and value companies are holding their own. Yeah, there's actually good research to show that the value companies hold up better during downturns quite often than large growth companies do, by far. And most people would think it would be just the opposite. You would think that big growth companies would do better because they're well known, they're well liked, and everybody, you know, fawns to them. But, you know, no, it's not the case. So we look at this Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund. You got 3,500 stocks. How much of it is in large companies? Answer, 77%. 77% of the portfolio. Wait a minute. It's the total stock market. There are 3,500 stocks. You mean 77% are just in big companies? Yeah, exactly. And if you look at just the top five holdings, okay, so you got 3,500 stocks. Now, five holdings, five stocks in that portfolio, because a mutual fund is what? You pool all our money and we buy a whole lot of stocks. Well, 3,500, you think you're well-diversified, but just the five top holdings make up over 11% of the portfolio. Yeah. Top 30 holdings make up over 33% of the portfolio. That's 30 holdings out of 3,500 make up 33% of the portfolio. Top 100 holdings, 55%. Top 500 holdings is, you know, we're not even up to, what, 1/6 of the portfolio yet. That's 85%. 85%. So you look at that and go, wait a minute. What? This is supposed to be diversified. It's not. It's marketing. And, you know, fund companies, they just rely on that. You're just not going to be paying attention. I'm just convinced that's the way it is. And, you know, that's probably right. Most people don't pay attention. Most people don't. Really, you know, you look at the number of people, I would love to reach the world with this show, but most people just aren't going to listen to it. You know, the reality is most people just want to blindly trust. And I always tell people that our firm, and I've told my guys forever, I said, you know, when you're talking to people and they come in to see you and they come in the office, you know, the reality of it is we're not for everybody, but we are for people that want to be engaged. That we want, you want to be engaged in the process. You want to understand a little bit about it. You don't have to understand everything. You don't have to know everything, but you have to at least be curious, because it is the person that is not curious that gets taken to the cleaners when it comes to investing. Okay, so let's talk, let's get a little bit of politics. I'm not going to get political, but I'm going to get into politics because it is the elephant in the room right now. Everybody's talking about it, and of course, I'll weigh in. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Was that? I don't remember. It's a terrible thing. The mind's a terrible thing to waste. You know, Josh, okay, so we were just talking about, I went back to what I said, 1970, I guess it was, and I was talking about markets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you love it when your computer does that to you. It went and changed the date on me. Oh, man.
Oh, man.
Okay, I got it. Okay, so from January of 1970, if you had put a dollar in large U.S. stocks, it grew to about $117 in the S&P 500. And I remember all the other asset categories I was talking about. It was much higher than that, about $1,000 in small value, using the FAMA French U.S. Small Value Research Index. For those of you that want to know where that number comes from, FAMA and French, they did the research on value. Okay, so back to U.S. large stocks, just the lowest performing area that of the market, $116. Guess what that same dollar grew to in 1 month treasury bills, which is basically government, you know, safe bonds, safe government bonds. What do you think?
I have no idea.
Oh, come on. No guts, no glory.
No guts, no glory, honestly.
All right. You're not going to get any glory. But anyway, but I like you anyway. It's $9.
Really?
Yeah. $9. So there you go. That's your rate of return. And what does it take now? I mean, shoot, you know, you think about it. Back 1970, you buy a house for about $30,000. Now it's $300,000.
Exactly.
So you're treading water. Not a whole lot going on there, huh?
Yeah, it is very true.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about something else. I'm going to switch. Okay, you've been watching Elizabeth Warren?
I have. I've been following as much as that as my brain can handle. I'll say that about you.
Yeah. Do you know she wrote a personal finance book?
Really?
It's like it's got a cult following, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah, she actually wrote a personal finance book, and she criticized, you know, the big banks and the credit card companies in it. And of course, that makes sense because she wants to cancel all these student loans and all of that stuff. So, so it has a cult following. I thought it was interesting that The Economist decided to write a little bit about her her campaign and some of the things she's thinking about doing. Now, what does that have to do with investing? Everything has a lot to do with investing, folks. So let me just talk a little bit through this. Warren's World, they had an article about this, and her plan was to reshape American capitalism for better and for worse. So they're looking at it and going, hey, you got a little bit of good and you got a little bit of bad in here. And a lot of you saying way more bad than good, you know, because the temperature of most of the people that would listen to this station would be like, I hate this stuff. And I look at it and go, you know, I've got to wear two hats. And you've heard me say this before. I'm going to wear two hats. I'm going to wear the hat if I'm the investor coach that is going to try to, as best I can, make you a successful investor. And then on the other side, you know, I've got the part of me that says I want to see a country succeed. And, I like to see, it's really interesting because I have a friend of mine, and he's a Dartmouth economist, and sharp. You know, one of the most brilliant economists. I that was my degree, so I was always thrilled when he would come on my radio show here, and we would talk about these things. And he would often talk about, you know, there's the truth that's in the middle so often with so many different things. And it seems like you have so many, all the extreme voices are what hit the media and are what are out there. All you ever hear is the extreme positions. And it seems to be that that's exactly what happens with political campaigns. People go to the extreme this way or extreme that way, and it's almost like they have to. And then you often hear that they govern in the middle. But, you know, so we have seen this over and over again in our history, and it just doesn't ever change. But, you know, in 1936, the article starts out, says Franklin Delano Roosevelt said that big businesses were lining up against his reelection. They're unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred, he says. And Elizabeth Warren is seeking Democratic nomination, and she's basically saying the same thing. I'm Elizabeth Warren. I'm approved this message, and she's doing some of the same type of talk about how she's going to straighten out the system and she's going to take on the system. Now, I'm going to try to remain as in the middle as I possibly can regarding this and just talk a little bit about markets, because that's what I'm interested in, and in investing and making you a successful investor. Now, she's saying that, and you know what's happening is that you got these people that are betting as to who's going to be the favorite, and she's getting a lot of momentum. It's like there has a 50% chance, I guess it was, that they said in this article, that she's going to grasp the nomination. And at this point in time, and you know, it's way too early to really get into this, but there's an issue, it could be Trump and blah, 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 and all of this stuff. So what would she do if she were in there? And one of the things they were talking about in this article was that, you know, you have to have, she says, you got to have fair markets, and markets have to come with rules. So you look at regulation, and it's really interesting when it comes to regulation. I have some issues with regulation that make me a little bit nuts, because I can see where the corruption can slip in when you have lots of regulations. And I'll talk about that probably a little bit later in the show. I've got a really specific example I want to give you based on something else I had been reading. But anyway, one of the things that is going on is that she's talking about the healthcare system, you know, talking about a wealth tax, targeting the super rich. She's promising a 2% annual levy on net worth over $50 million, rising to 3% on fortunes above $1 billion. And here's the reality. Around the world, rich people are pretty good at avoiding these types of taxes. If you look around the world, you'll find that the complexity of working this thing out is such that there were 12 countries that had such a tax in 1990, and now there are really only 3 countries that have it, and it's dropping because it's just really, really difficult. What do rich people do when you try to tax them? They leave. I use the example, and I've used it many times, of the Rolling Stones, you know, going and recording an album in like 1970, it was Exile on Main Street, and they picked up their toys and they left Great Britain and they headed off to France to record the album because they didn't want to pay the taxes. And then you got this thing about Medicare for All. And, you know, I have physician clients and we talk about this stuff, and they talk about reimbursement rates, and a lot of them is like, I'd be out of the industry. I'd be just, that's it. I'm headed someplace else, I'm going to do something else. And there are some of them that I've heard say, well, you know what, I'll be a concierge doctor, and you pay me on the side, and the rich people are going to do just fine. It's going to be the poor that are going to be hurt by this, because they're the ones that aren't going to be getting the service. The wealthy are going to hire people like me to work with them on the side, and you know, that's the reality of things. And there was one doctor I actually talked to, and he says, well, I kind of like it, because then what would happen is you would have models for how you treat everything. And then they can't sue you as long as you go by the model. I thought, wow, that's lovely. Now, the other thing that they said would be at risk was private equity, which is interesting, because that's something that I often talk about that we don't touch as investors. I don't touch it, haven't touched it. A lot of the good private equity investments don't ever see the light of the day for investors, you know, there are a few people that get the benefit of it, and it's typically handed out as candy to a few select investors for, you know, some of these investment firms. But, you know, you typically find the garbage private equity deals are what end up in the mutual funds and the investments that the public get to invest in. So I've stayed away from them, but I think it's very interesting that even, you know, just all of them could be at risk, according to this article in The Economist. She has this Stop Wall Street Looting Act, and she's talking about introducing to the Senate changes the way private equity firm employees' income is taxed. You know, and this is where you hit the Warren Buffett thing, where he talks about, you know, my secretary pays higher taxes than me and blah, blah, blah. We're talking about capital gains taxes. And you'll have these people paying capital gains taxes at 23.8% versus, you know, where a high-income earner will be taxed at regular tax rates up to 37%. And if she gets her way, you know, probably have, of course, much higher tax rates than even that. You know, so that's another thing that they're talking about. Now, she's also talking about reviving Glass-Steagall Act, which is something I've been talking to some of my friends about, one of the ladies that works for me, Anne, who is an attorney, and she worked in securities. She was an attorney up in Wisconsin, and she worked in the securities industry, writing prospectuses for investment companies, and she's very, very familiar with securities law. And she and I were talking about this, and I said, isn't it interesting that they're talking about reviving this? And just at a time when you're starting to see this weird stuff going on in the investment industry, where some of the biggest investment firms are making most of their money on banking operations. So literally you'll have these companies are racing to zero on management fees. And the reason is they're hiding expenses elsewhere. And it could be that she comes in and says, we're going to put a stop to this too. So, you know, I look at it and go, there's some of this stuff that I see from my side of the fence that I am very, very frustrated about, that companies get away with stuff because the public is not aware and they're not paying attention to what's going on. This one's interesting. You know, talking about big companies having 40% of their board seats reserved for workers' representatives. And you look at this stuff and go, well, okay, here we go. What would happen? What would a company do? And this is where I put my investment coaching hat on. And I go, you know, if this is really ends up being bad for companies, then what they're going to do, I'm just going to tell you, they're going to pick up their toys and they're going to go someplace else. They will find, if they have to replace workers with machines, they'll replace workers with machines. And this kind of stuff doesn't last. Typically what will happen is if they try to do something, they stub their toe, and all of a sudden companies' profits go down, or they decide that they're going to pull out and get out of the country altogether. Then what will happen is government revenue is going to go down. It'll cause all kinds of problems, and then they will have to backtrack. They will have to change their ways and go a different direction. You know, so for me, this is why I diversify, quite frankly. This is why I diversify portfolios. I don't put all my eggs in any one basket. I've got them all over the world. And the reason is because you just don't really know how this stuff will go. And this is why it's so stinking important to make sure that you don't have the concentration that we typically see that investors have. You have all that concentration, and all of a sudden change like this happens, and you could be in a world heap big amount of trouble when it gets down to it. And markets are going to handicap this stuff as the election gets closer. Markets will actually start to price in who they think is going to win, so you're not going to be able to use what you think is going to happen to try to time the markets with any degree of success, most likely, because you've got to have better information than the sum total of all informed people that watch this stuff day after day, and their money depends on it. Not likely to happen. Paul Winkler, you're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Man, Josh, don't ever have kids. No, I am totally joking. Totally joking. Love them dearly. My son just called me on the break. He's like, his timing's perfect. As soon as I go on break, bam, the phone rings. And
he also has the internal radio clock.
You think so?
You may so. You never know. Which is, if he wants to get into radio, tell him to run. So.
Well, he's going to run. Well, he's He's got that other thing that I probably should tell him to run from too, which is music.
Most definitely.
Don't you think, man?
Oh, most definitely.
Oh man, it's just funny. He's got all kinds of, you know, hobbies that he's into. Yeah, he's getting into the photography thing though too, which isn't so bad.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, you know, it's not bad. He's been getting into that as well. So, anyway, you know, he's got a good head on his shoulders. So whatever he does, he's gonna be all right.
Better than being stuck in your phone, because I feel like a lot of people my age and younger, that's all they do, man. Their nose is in their phone constantly, and they're not going out and experiencing things.
You know, and it's interesting because you look at the level of depression. And, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, being self-focused, it's really hard not to be a little bit depressed because you're constantly focused on yourself and constantly focused on, you know, what do I look like to other people and other people approving of me. You know, as a matter of fact, third hour of the show I'm going to talk about, I actually had a workshop that I taught this week. And it was super, super interesting. I got into millionaires, and I got into the statistics on millionaires. And I'm going to share some of that stuff. And what I got into was a conversation with the group, which was really, really cool. And in regards to what is one of the biggest reasons people don't accumulate money for the future? And you know what it gets down to is it gets down to these things that we plug in our brains when we're younger, and the things that happen to us, and how it affects our spending habits later in just ways you just never really think about. It's absolutely fascinating. And then I got into a conversation with a guy, and he was into collectibles and things like that, and that made for some interesting conversation.
As the Brad Paisley song says, we're so much cooler online.
I had not heard that. And that's interesting. Well, I was talking to somebody this week about collectibles, and they were just talking about how the rate of return, you know, they're trying to get rid of their parents' collectibles is such a challenge. You know, their parents collect stuff like crazy, and they just hoard all of this stuff. And she was talking about, you know, the papers and things like that, and reports from she was in grade school, and just, you know, crazy stuff that, you know, that people collect thinking that they're going to be worth something one day. Brought it to a pawn shop, and the guy looks at it, and brought it to one of those antique dealers, and looks at it and goes, nobody wants any of this stuff. She says, yeah, try to convince my mom of that. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, Supertalk 99.7 WTN.
This is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.